Hey, Brian.
What's up, Mickey? Long time no talk.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Was that your Joey Tribbiani impression?
That was my really bad Joey Tribbiani impression.
Fantastic. And
if people are really big Friends aficionados, then they may be able to tie that back to the Easter egg of how we name our shows.
Yes. That is something that we started this calendar year, 2020. So you and I, I tell you, I am still exhausted between the travel back from VS Live Las Vegas, which we were at all last week, trying to get caught up on some work, trying to catch up with family, and then the time change on Sunday here in the United States. I'm about done. And I had to get up. I had a call this morning with a customer on Eastern time. So I was up at 5 a.m., which felt like 4 a.m. And so I'm a little tired. I feel like at times an old man, and in other days I feel like a young puppy. I had fun with you in Vegas, though. It was a good show. How are you doing? Because you had to travel back home and fly.
So for those of you listening to this, we're recording this on Monday, March 9th. And Brian and I spent all of last week at VS Live Las Vegas, to where I actually flew out the day before. Brian and I worked on some stuff. Then we drove to Las Vegas, drove through the desert. That was awesome. Worked really hard at VS Live. Then I came back to Brian's house, and then I flew out on Saturday. And one of the things I've noticed flying back out, Brian, was that the airport in Atlanta was a lot less busy than it normally is. The Sky Club that I went to actually had seats, like good available seats, and usually this one on this concourse is extremely packed. So I can see where people are cutting back on air travel, more than likely due to the COVID-19.
It's going to be interesting because I fly out tomorrow, and I'm going on my local airport, ONT, to Denver, which is DEN for those keeping score. And I'm interested to see how it is, because in the month of February, I flew in and out of those airports about 6 times each, I guess it would be, based upon the number of trips I did. And so I have a current point of reference to see the reduction in the number of people both in the airport. I'm interested to see my flight, if it's lighter than usual, as well as naturally how things are at the airport. So we'll see. But on that note,
You're still talking. I'll let you talk, and then I'll say something.
No worries. Sorry. We'll work this out one day. The last thing I was going to say is that in spite of COVID-19, VS Live was fine. We didn't have any sick people there. We weren't the epicenter of a new outbreak, and we are doing the next show in Austin at the end of March, first week of April, in lovely Austin, Texas. So come on out. With a lot of conferences canceling, ours is not, 20,000 people. So you don't have to worry about being infected by thousands of people. There'll be hundreds of people that you can come be with. And so if you want to get in-person tech time, come be there, because I'll be there regardless, COVID-19 or no COVID-19. I got to make a living. So there you go.
But to go back to your point, you asked how I was doing, and I'm kind of like you. I'm recovering from travel, recovering from the time change, recovering from the shift in time zones. So today for me was obviously getting some work done, doing that kind of those expense reports and things like that. But I'm also rebooting what I'm calling my DevOps Customer Advisory Team Book Club. So one of the things we have at Microsoft is we are very pro diversity and inclusivity. And so in order to try to help drive that even more, I've started a book club with my team where we're reading a book called Erasing Institutional Bias. And so what I'm going to do is every week we're going to have a new chapter that we discuss, and we're going to do this both ad hoc through our Teams channel, as well as probably have a once a week meeting to where we just, have a chance to discuss, ask questions, get an understanding of what people may have encountered or how they've handled it when they've seen other people encounter it, and just try to, broaden everybody's horizons a little bit. So I started working on that today, and I'll probably keep working on that some tomorrow. But I'm very excited about this project. So I'm excited to report back over the next few weeks and let our listeners know how it goes.
Awesome. That sounds great. So I think the last thing before we get into the rest of our episode is you had some success in Las Vegas in your free time. Did you play some slots by chance?
I did, Brian. I did play some slots, but not just your regular everyday slot machine that has like the bar, bar, bar or the cherry, cherry, cherries. I played something called Buffalo Gold. And the neat thing about Buffalo Gold is it's kind of a video slot machine, but if you hit three coins, then you get free spins and the game starts playing itself and you just sit there. And then as it hits more coins, it gets more spins and it hits. At one point in time, I had 40 free spins that it was just spinning through and generating. So I had a little bit of luck. I was pleased. It was fun. It was a good way to spend an hour and a half.
Sweet, sweet. Well, I'm glad to hear that. All right. So without further ado, we're going to switch and we apologize. We continue to work on audio. Hopefully in the next month or two, we'll have it figured out what works best. But we couldn't pass up an opportunity in Vegas to interview one of our co-presenters, another speaker. And so we're going to transition into that interview, which was done last week in Las Vegas. And we use different equipment. So like I said, apologies in advance, but hopefully you enjoy it. And without further ado, let's switch over to the interview. Hey, Mickey.
Hi, Brian.
You're kind of loud, you know that?
I've been accused of that in the past. That is true. But that's just the singer voice in me and the using the diaphragm and the hair and the ho and the hair.
All right, Mickey's excited because we're recording live together in Las Vegas. We're going to have our second very special guest, but as we mentioned, this is DevOps.fm, where we're going to talk about anything and everything DevOps. So, Mickey, you having a good week here in Las Vegas?
I am having a good week. How about yourself?
Not too bad. We're here in Las Vegas for Visual Studio Live, the first show of 2020. Mickey and I did a hands-on lab covering the wonder that is GitHub and DevOps. We did some ASP.NET Core, played with packages, repos, pull requests, the magic of Dependabot security, and all sorts of good stuff. But the nice thing about being in Vegas is you and I are not here alone. In contrast to some of our road gigs, we're here this week with a cornucopia of talented speakers, and we have our second guest for the show in the room.
Wait, can I qualify that? We have a cornucopia of talented speakers, and then we got Phil. Who is one of the top of that cornucopia. He is like, well, I guess if a cornucopia is like the thing on the side with the fruit coming out, he's like the big thing of grapes.
Hey, what is Tupelo, Mississippi known for?
Oh, we've already covered that. That was episode one. So we have no actual bio intro for Phil. So without further ado, we'll just say, hi, Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Hey, guys.
Phil, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself to get this going?
So my name's Phil Japixi, and I've been programming for, well, it seems like forever. Focused mostly in the .NET space, but I also do a lot of agile work and more DevOps as the job requires. I run a consulting company back home. I'm the chief architect in the Microsoft space for them.
And you also run a conference, if I'm not mistaken.
I do. I do run a conference. It's called Cincy Deliver. It's in July. So it's Cincy as in Cincinnati, C-I-N-C-Y, Deliver. And it's all about delivering software.
So I'm sure you can give me a link to put in the show notes for everybody who's in the area and wants to come down and hang out at your
Absolutely. CincyDeliver.org.
Fantastic. So, Phil, you mentioned, you know, you're known for doing .NET. You've done a little writing, haven't you? Why don't you do a little pimping on your writing real quick?
Sure. I've got, I've got 8 books that I've published. Some of them have fallen away. The Windows 8 books didn't do all that well. But the current books I have right now, I've got the top-selling book on C# with the A-Press, and that was a collaboration with Andrew Trolson. And then I've also got a book on building web applications with .NET Core and JavaScript that I did with Ben Dewey and Kevin Gross-Nicholas.
So how did you find writing books? Do you like it? Do you not like it? I've written a few books. I'm not sure if I'll do another one.
It is tedious at best, but rewarding in the long run. So the reason I started the building web applications with .NET Core was I wanted to learn it. I knew it was the future, but it was so rough at the time. It was still called ASP.NET 5. It was Project JSON. And I knew I couldn't go to a customer and say, hey, let's do this new thing. And one way to really learn a technology is to write about it. When you're on stage at a conference and you make an oops and you misstate something, everybody forgets about it. You put it in writing, it's there forever. So you really got to make sure that when you're writing stuff down in a book that it's right. So it takes a lot more research, a lot more testing.
Yeah, that is the problem of writing or recording videos. You know, as much as you edit, once it's out there, then it's always that moment. It's that errata moment in your book. You're like, oh, darn it. And that's one thing when there's a typo or something that's just kind of out of whack. It's when maybe you just don't get something because it's new or you had it right. And then Microsoft changes it and it's totally different by the time readers get to it.
Well, and that's with the C-sharp book. So I'm working on the C-sharp 8 version right now, and it's a mere 1,600 pages, so it shouldn't take me long, right? But the biggest problem with that book is I have to completely rewrite everything in .NET Core. There's great material on garbage collection, memory management, and threading that Andrew wrote initially, and it applies in .NET Classic, as I'm calling Framework 4.8. But that has significantly changed in Core. And so I'm digging down to something that's not well documented to try and figure out how this stuff works. I want to make sure I get it right.
So you spend a lot of time writing and working as, you know, I'd call you definitely a journeyman programmer. And I do mean that as a sincere compliment, having gotten to work with you last couple of months. The next step, though, of course, is it's one thing to program and write by yourself, but team development. And you mentioned you do some stuff with Agile. You know, talk to that for a second, and then maybe take us down the journey how Agile kind of got mixed with, you know, DevOps, a little bit of, you know, chocolate and peanut butter.
Yeah, certainly. So for a long time, for those of us who have been programming as long as Brian and I have, Mickey is a fresh young kid, so he hasn't been around that long. We did a lot of work on our own, right? We sat in a corner in cube walled areas, and every occasion we'd prairie dog and they'd slide some pizza toward us, and we just worked off a 200-page requirements document. And that's really not an effective way to work. The most effective way to work is through collaboration. The problem with collaboration, if you're working in the same project, then you're stepping on each other's toes. And I remember back in the day of I'm going to throw up a little bit as I say this, but Visual Source Safe, where you couldn't really merge, right? So you had to almost sneaker net the code between people's computers so you could get it into source control. You know, Subversion was better. We won't talk about TFS VC, but Git certainly is come a long, long way. The problem still is, whereas branching is super simple, merging is always hard. And so it takes a little different mindset, right? A lot of times as developers, we want to work on something until we get it right. But what we need to do now is work on something till we get it right enough. In other words, it compiles. It might not be completely done, but you should check in as often as you can. And on a really, like when I'm in the zone, I'm probably checking in about every 15, 20 minutes. And that's, you know, counting writing unit tests and everything else. And the advantage there is as my team is working with me and they're checking in at the same time, yeah, we'll have a merge conflict or two, but they're very minor and very quick to resolve. But if you've got this entire branch that is Phil's branch, another branch that's Mickey's branch, and then 3 months down the road, we try and merge, it's going to be a nightmare.
Now, you said something, and since we're in the same room, I got to watch Mickey's eyeballs light up. So I take it you weren't a fan of TFVC.
I was never a fan of the centralized repository system for a number of reasons, but I'll tell you the main one, as much as I travel, trying to work on a team project with TFSVC where everything is right locked on your machine until you check it out. And of course, you don't want to have everything checked out for a week while you're traveling. So we'd have to do things like go into the file system, change the read-write properties. So then we would be able to get work done and then, you know, spend the next week trying to merge.
All right. Well, I've always argued to some degree some of that pain was partly a fundamental inability to work in smaller batches, number one, as you've alluded to,
And then number two, yes, not always working the best with the version control tool, because for a lot of developers, they're just expected to know how to use version control and they get dropped into the deep end. And so it's a combination, I think, of overall team process and the tool. But like you said, you know, Git is really, it's one. It is the de facto version control system. Azure DevOps supports it, obviously GitHub. And then we have things like Bitbucket and GitLab and other companies providing shared services around the Git version control system.
Yeah, and Git's not perfect. I mean, I'm still not a fan of the fact that you can rewrite history. And we have an awesome motorcycle driving outside our window here.
I would just like to point out that we are on like the 9th or the 10th floor of this hotel, and yet it is still super loud. So if you do hear random noises throughout the podcast or police sirens or other things, I promise we are all okay.
Well, if you hear police sirens and the podcast suddenly stops, we're probably not.
Good point.
But yeah, I mean, everything has its flaws. So you take what tools out there and you work, you know, within what it gives you to become better. You know, one of the big advantages of Azure DevOps is it's a complete AOM solution. You know, I've worked in the past with Jira, a TFS before that. And TFS, I'm probably going to get some hate mail from this. I think TFS was okay, but it wasn't the best of any breed, but it had all the breeds. So it was a jack of all trades, master of none. And I think what's really different about Azure DevOps is they really have striven to be the best of breed in all their different areas. But better than that, if you don't like the way a part of it works, you can plug in your own part.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the significant changes. You know, granted, you know, Azure DevOps is the evolution of TFS, but fundamentally, they also made the realization that sometimes people are very happy with some other existing way of doing things. And that's what you see today. You'd rather use GitHub for repos? Great, you can do that. You really like pipelines? Awesome. On the other hand, you like the boards feature integrated with repos, but you've already using Team City? You can do that too. And that took a lot for Microsoft to do that and say, we're going to make really fantastic pieces. And yeah, if you snap them together, it's going to be like a great Lego set. But on the other hand, use the pieces that work for you to deliver solutions that deliver value to your users.
Yeah, and you had asked me before, and we got lost in the motorcycles racing up and down the parkway here, how, you know, the team development has changed, how Azure DevOps has changed it. And I go back to, you know, I had a call with a potential customer this week, and I asked them what they had one developer, that person left, they had, you know, kind of a rotating door of developers. And I said, well, where's your source code? You know, what source code system are you using? And they said, well, it's all in a file share. And I paused because what I was going to say out loud, you don't do to a potential customer. And he said, I know, it's horrible. The only thing I can say in my defense is I'm not a developer. I know this is a problem. So I do have a backup of all the source code offsite in the data center. But one of the first things we're going to do is we're going to go through all the code they have, and we're going to start putting them up in an Azure repos. Right. If nothing else, it's a secure place, right? It's in the cloud. You know, if you accidentally format your hard drive, then you still have the code. There's replication in the cloud, things like that. But it really becomes a team sport. And you excel as a team when you really understand how to work as a team. And that is not just checking in all the time, because you could be coding whatever and checking in, it doesn't mean you're doing the right thing. The other thing that's really nice about Azure DevOps is we have done away with requirements documents, right? I don't even want to see them. We start every project with a story mapping exercise. That story map gets put into a board, not necessarily your work board, because coming out of a story map, it's not always workable stories, as we would typically refer to that term, but it's all the items that the business cares about and they're prioritized. So then we take those items that are prioritized and we digest them and we break them down into workable increments. And whether we're doing Kanban or Scrum, I don't care. I'm not going to get in that debate here. The fact of the matter is you have to know what people are working on for a couple of reasons, right? So we're consultants. So sometimes you're going to have somebody from the business say, what are we paying you guys for? And if you've got that trackability in Azure DevOps in the boards to say, here are all the stories we completed. Here are, you know, when we completed them, when they were deployed. You know, that's kind of a line of defense in case, you know, we get somebody who's not involved with the project teams and looking at expenses. But even more so, we don't have people working on the same thing at the same time, which had happened all the time when you had a 200-page requirements document. But you also get the right things worked on the right order. You know, one of the big failures in Waterfall was the fact you had a requirements document where you'd have 10,000 requirements and 9,050 of them are high priority and 25 are medium priority and 25 are low priority, right? So what that does is give the development team 9,950 choices of what to work on. And they're going to work on things that are easy, fun, or resume building, not necessarily what's best for the business. So now that you have boards where you can prioritize and people self-assign to what they're working on, you can look at the board, say, this one's in flight. All right, what's next in line? All right, I'm going to assign myself this story and start working on it. And the business can then track through the board where these projects are. One of the biggest advantages I had of using, it was a fairly large project. We still had project managers. It was a big corporation. And I just took Post-its. I had a whiteboard behind my cube and I put Post-its on it and I built a Kanban board. And I was just tracking the things I was working on. And the project manager came around one day, you know, with the obligatory Microsoft project open on her laptop and said, you know, what percentage done are you? And I said, Susie, if you have any questions about where I am, whether I'm here or not, look at the board behind you. It'll show you what I have due to work, what I'm working on, and what I've completed. And I don't do percentages. It's done or not done. And that's the information that you will need for your Microsoft project report. And that was the last time she talked to me on the project. Not because she was mad, because she didn't have to talk to me to get a status, right? She just came by my desk and looked.
That's one of the things I always pushed in the beginning with Team Foundation Server for Teams as a way to get them to put in good commits and check-ins and to make sure that they associate with the work items, whether it was task-based or story, you know, PBI-based, was that if you do this, the pointy-haired bosses of the world won't come bug you and ask you if you're done yet, because we can give them a digital readout of what's going on, as well as we could, you know, TFS, you could even print reports. And so it was a way to say, look, if you're feeling introverted and you don't want to deal with management, this can really help you if you just do your job.
Yeah, and I remember in 2002, we were working for a significantly large company in the automotive industry, and it was one of the first big .NET projects, and there are plenty of Microsoft consulting services people there, as well as myself and some other folks from Microsoft partners. And we had a rule, two rules. One was you couldn't leave the building with any code checked out because we were using TFS VC. And the other rule was that we would build twice a day, 2 p.m. and 2 a.m. And so if the 2 a.m. build broke, you had until 2 p.m. to try and fix it. And then, you know, same thing with your 12 hours. And I just remember that being such a monumental change from the way things worked before, because, yeah, even if you were using some sort of source control, at some point in time, you had to make sure the stuff all built and everything else. And now with the modern source control, as soon as you check in, things are building. You're running the tests, right? You know, get that rapid feedback that you need to make sure that you're on the right path.
So I would argue that as a journeyman programmer, you'd say that good team practices and what we are now calling DevOps really makes a lot of sense.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's always going to be those projects where it just takes one person to knock it out of the park. You know, somebody in the travel department is tracking tickets with an Excel spreadsheet, right? Do you need a whole team to do that? No. We are right now working with a significant, one of the largest and fastest growing law firms in Chicago, and very complicated software. And if we tried to do this on our own, we wouldn't get done. And the advantage of having a team doing it is everybody brings their own dish to the buffet, right? You don't want to have everybody who's bringing an appetizer or a dessert, or me who tends to go to Kroger and buys the big plate of cookies because I forgot to make something. But you have people who specialize. Now, you want that cross-team compatibility where people can do other people's jobs if necessary. But we all have those things we enjoy doing, and we have those things we're really good at. And when you get together as a well-functioning team, then you can leverage those top skills where it's needed, and you move much faster than you would otherwise.
So you said that you're running a team at where you work. What have you found in your experience that you, when you're working with programmers, trying to pull them together cohesively as a team, are there any tips or tricks or anything you found that really help as far as to really bring the team and make them a cohesive unit where they're, you know, running on all cylinders and really cooking with gas?
So I know this is going to be not well liked in this day and age where everybody's pushing for remote, but I have a policy that, you know, between core hours of the day, and that's around 9:30 in the morning to about 2:30 in the afternoon, I want everybody in the office. Of course, if you have something going on at home, then, you know, be at home. But just having, and I run more than one team, so I have 12 people that work for me, but we're doing multiple projects. I'm the architect for all of them. Some of them I'm doing more coding on than others. But having everybody, and we sit in an open space. It's a big horseshoe. And I don't allow headphones, which kind of gets people twitchy at times. The disadvantage of that is, yeah, you can get a little distracted by what's going on. The super advantage to that is you're getting distracted by people talking about their projects. And now you're listening in, and, you know, almost daily I'll hear somebody say, hey, I did something like that, right? I know how to do that. While two of the developers are pairing and trying to work through something. And it just brings everybody up, and it brings everybody together. We tend to have lunch every, it's not a requirement, but we tend to go to lunch together as a team. You know, some people want to pack or have to run errands, don't. But just having everybody in that same room working together, I think just builds them as a team. Now, as the boss, sometimes I have to interject and remind them that they are at work and that they need to focus a little. But that's few and far between. One thing that was interesting in the beginning, so the consulting company that I work for has never had had a project team like what I've assembled. And it was just, you know, staff aug, right? High-end staff aug, but, you know, everybody spread out. And so I started putting this team together. So this group of people had never really worked together. They see each other, you know, once a month at a company meeting. And personalities were interesting. They still are. And at one point in time, it had gotten a little rough in there. And I know that I've ruffled some of the academic agilis with this, but I literally just pulled everybody into the conference room and I said, I'm walking out of this conference room and you are not leaving until you work this out. And when you figure out how to work together, feel free to come out of the conference room. If it gets to the point where I have to get involved, and we joke around by saying if dad has to get involved, then people get in trouble, right? And it took them about a half hour. And they realized what kind of opportunity they had to work together since they'd been by themselves in different companies for so long. And they came out, and that was like almost the immediate bonding experience right there.
So you brought up something that I'd like to go back to for a second, which is you're all in one big open space.
Correct.
So one of the things that we've been doing at Microsoft is this whole concept of team rooms, where we're putting the entire feature team or the entire team in a big open space. And there are some people that love it. There's some people that hate it. There's some people, there's research that shows it works, research that shows it doesn't. It sounds like in your perspective, it seems to be working well for your team.
It is. It's working exceptionally well. And it takes, just as it takes the right person to be effective remote, it takes the right person to be a team player. Unfortunately, this industry is kind of geared towards, and not by need, but kind of by design or by accident, it's geared to having people that don't want to talk to other people, that tend to be a little antisocial, or at least that's a perception. And for a long time, and I've been in this industry since the 80s, it's been that way. What makes you much more effective, like coming to a conference, it's not just about attending the sessions. It's also about networking and talking to other people and getting those connections, right? And when you have a team that works together and fights together, I mean, it's like your siblings, right? You know, if you have any brothers, you probably had some fights with them when you were growing up. but you love each other now. You might not like each other, but you love each other. And that's how your team is, right? I don't expect these people to blend their lives outside of work. Many of them do, but that's not an expectation, right? The expectation is when you're here and they get to do some other day remote, like I said, you know, they don't have to be there all 8 hours. But when you're here, you're working and you're working together. And it works.
So I'm going to switch gears again. And as far as I'm concerned, you're one of an expert as far as .NET Core. And I'm just curious, what do you like the most about .NET Core?
There's so many things I like. So that's why I'm hesitating a little bit and trying not to and ah too much. From an ASP.NET Core standpoint, what I like the most is they fixed some of the most annoying things that we had in ASP.NET Classic. That's the configuration system, the kind of weak support for dependency injection, and also the proliferation of Razor code. So the configuration system, almost every time I demo the new configuration environmental awareness in ASP.NET Core, somebody in the crowd does a woohoo, right? Because they've been burned in the past by web.config. When I talk about dependency injection, I mean, it's just seamless now. A lot of us were already doing it because you could plug it into MVC, but you had to know how to plug it in. And then the tag helpers make it immensely easier to work in an enterprise or even a team environment because the tag helpers are representing Razor code that executes server-side, but they just go into a plain old HTML tag so that you can hand it off to a designer and they'll know how to style it without having to understand what HTML.begin form translates to. From an EF Core standpoint, they just fixed it. I used EF and any framework since version 4, struggled with it. Version 5 is a little better. Version 6 was certainly workable. The team has they've been amazing in how they ripped apart the code and put it back in. I showed a demo yesterday of EF Core 3.1 versus EF Core 6.4, which is the version of EF Core that can run in .NET Core, but it's still, the version of EF 6, EF Classic, naming is so hard, that can run in .NET Core, and literally doing the exact same exercise, both hitting AdventureWorks database on my database, there was an order of magnitude difference in performance, and it's executing the exact same code against the exact same databases.
So would you say that developers, if you're doing .NET development, that it is essential that you start learning .NET Core?
So that is that's a trap question. Thank you very much, Mickey. So here's what I tell everybody, and I strongly recommend it. If you are doing new development, it needs to be in .NET Core. 4.8 is not going to go any farther than 4.8. That will be supported for at least 9 more years, probably more than 10, as the traditional Microsoft support policy is. Plus 4.8 is part of the operating system, right? So it's not little green aliens aren't going to come and uninstall any of your ASP.NET MVC apps off your machine. Should you be moving to Core? Absolutely. However, there's plenty of people who are still making a lot of money on COBOL. So as more and more people move to Core, there's going to be higher demand for people doing .NET Classic. So I'm not here to give you career advice, but I will say from a technology standpoint, if you're doing any new project, if you're doing any new project in .NET, it needs to be .NET Core.
Awesome. That was a well done answer for someone who's been doing this for a long time. So Phil, thank you so much for coming and joining our Ragtag podcast. We'll definitely want to have you on again. And
yeah, it'd be great.
See where the world has taken us. But for now, we're going to sign off and say thanks for joining us on DevOps.fm.
And don't forget the after party. Welcome to the after party, everybody.
Are we doing this now?
Of course we are, because Phil's here. He could be part of the after party.
Woo! All right, well, after party it is, because it is Thursday, and so you know what that means for Brian.
Picard.
That's right. New episode of Picard. Episode 7.
So, Phil, in case you don't know, because we really did give you no heads up, what we tend to do is just kind of ramble for a few minutes after we record the podcast. Not that the podcast isn't rambling itself.
I was going to say, that isn't really different from what we did before.
Correct. But we just tend to talk for a few minutes, and we tend to talk about something that we can't let go of each week. So it's something over the past week that we just can't let go of.
And so with our first guest, we didn't have that opportunity. So you'll be the first guest to tell us something non-work or DevOps related that you can't let go of.
So maybe we should, one of us should go first to kind of let Phil understand. So Brian is not ready. So I'm going to wing it. So what this is a Mickey, what Mickey can't let go of. So right now, I'll be honest, one of the things that's top of my mind that I can't let go of is a lot of the stuff that's going on in the U.S. right now about around, say, the COVID-19 virus and conferences closing, or not closing, but conferences canceling and conferences delaying. I've actually heard that there's a website, haveibeencanceled.com or hasitbeencanceled.com, one of those two, where they have a list of conferences where they will outline whether those conferences have been canceled or not. So, you know, obviously conference cancellations, work travel cancellations, those things affect when I'm on the road and when I'm not. So it's something that's kind of top of mind for me. So that's kind of my what I can't let go of.
So for me, it turns out it's a beverage. I was out in Lansing, Michigan a couple weeks ago doing a class, and one of my students was kind enough to give me some energy in a can. And so right now I'm really enjoying Rockstar's non-carbonated orange with natural flavors, which has 10 calories and a whole lot of other interesting stuff in it, like caffeine, taurine, and electrolytes, and B vitamins. But that's me. It's a beverage this week, folks. And of course, Picard.
B vitamins, always important. All right, you had your chance. What is it that you can't let go of, Phil?
Well, as we were flying in, because there's a bunch of us on the plane, but just not Brian and Mickey. So we, the collective sense, passengers on a plane flying in to Vegas, we flew over the big lake. Was that Lake Mead? Is that what it's called? Really big lake, and made me wonder if, are they ever going to rescue those castaways?
I'm sorry?
Gilligan, Marianne, the professor, the billionaire and his wife who shall not be named.
Oh, Phil.
Hey, you blindside me, I blindside you right back.
All right. Well, we're a bunch of dorks. And for now, we really are going to sign off. We'll see you next time on DevOps.fm.
Bye, everybody.
Whoa, we're back from the past into the present.
You know, it's time travel. I love it. I love podcasting time travel. So I had a lot of fun. Phil is absolutely fantastic. He's a really nice guy, really smart. And what I love about Phil is just he approaches things from a how do I deliver value for my customers. He's a journeyman programmer and really just has a ton of experience, very practical. But he's also the first person to tell you, hey, I don't know. I've not done that. Don't know what's going on. And so I was really excited, really happy to have him as a guest as well. God, I can talk.
I agree. And I thought it was a fun way to do one of our first in-person interviews. As you mentioned, we were trying out some new audio equipment. So the audio quality is okay, but you know, bear with us, as Brian said. But Phil is just, I thought it was a great interview. He covered a lot of good points. We threw a lot of different questions at him. And I'll leave it to the listener to determine why Phil's Twitter handle is Ski Medic.
Ah.
If you can figure out why Phil's Twitter handle is Ski Medic, and you can email us at theshow@devops.fm, then I'm not necessarily going to promise you anything, but I'll at least read your email on the show.
There you go. You'll give a shout out.
A shout out. There you go. That's what the cool kids are saying now, is a shout out.
I don't know if it's the cool kids saying it, but oh well. So on that bombshell, we kind of already did the post show and all that good stuff. So I think it's just a matter of wrapping up this show with a bow. So if you want to find me, occasionally I blog at blog.brianrandall.com. Twitter, I'm @BrianRandall. Or you can get me via email, brianr@mcwtech.com. And as always, that info is in the show notes.
And I am located at mickeygousset.com, where I just put up a brand new post with links to all of my talks from VS Live. I can also find me on Twitter at Mickey_Gousset. I will keep my underscore until I die. Or you can send me an email at mickey.gousset@microsoft.com.
Fantastic. And also, if you don't want to communicate directly with us, if it's just the show you care about, you can find us on the web at devops.fm or email theshow@devops.fm. As always, thanks for listening. Be good humans.
Bye, everybody.